Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi pays an official visit to Oman. This is part of Tehran's efforts to boost relations with neighboring countries. China issues a strong warning to the U.S. after President Biden promises to defend Taiwan in case of Beijing's attempt to take control of the island. Australia's Labor leader Anthony Albanese is sworn in as Prime Minister, ending nearly a decade of conservative rule in that country. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Top story this hour, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has arrived in Oman on an official visit, expansion of bilateral cooperation, topping the agenda. Raisi was welcomed by Oman's Sultan Haytham bin Tariq upon arrival at his official Al Alam Palace. The president said that before his departure for Moscow, that Iran and Oman are determined to upgrade their already close political and economic ties. Raisi noted the two sides will sign several memoranda of understanding during the visit. These, he said, will mainly focus on transportation, energy, and tourism. The Raisi administration is pursuing a policy of strengthening relations with neighboring countries. The Middle East expert Saeed Chahabi has given us a wider picture of Iran-Oman ties as President Raisi is visiting Muscat.
Oman has always been close to Iran, the latest of which was the transfer of the Iranian money which was paid by Britain 2 months ago. It was facilitated through Oman. It went through the through Oman Central Bank so that the issue was sorted out. So Oman played a significant role in facilitating relations between and negotiations even with the Americans regarding the outstanding American debt to Iran. So that is in addition to they both countries share the Hormuz Straits, the Straits of Hormuz, which is one of the most important lanes of for oil shipping in the world. So all in all, Oman and Iran have enjoyed it, enjoyed this relation, and President Raisi has repeated his assurances that he would consider improving the relations with the neighborhood. And Oman, of course, stands as the first important destination. And we should not forget that only 2 weeks ago, or last week, in fact, the Qatari Emir was in Tehran for the first time for a long time. So all in all, Iran is enjoying a relatively positive relations with its neighbors now.
Now, speaking prior to his trip to Oman, Iranian President ordered a serious investigation into the assassination of a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Ibrahim Raisi pledged revenge for the killing of Colonel Sayed Khodai. He said that the arrogant world powers were involved in the crime. The RGC colonel was assassinated in his car in front of his home in Tehran on Sunday. He was shot 5 times by 2 motorcyclists. The foreign ministry has described the assassination as a terrorist operation and inhumane crime. The ministry says it's regrettable to see countries claiming to be fighting terror are silent on the assassination. U.S. sanctions have severely impacted human rights. That's a grim assessment by a top human rights official who has slammed the U.S. for its brutal sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Elena Duhan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000 and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Duhan said, the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of the sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The UN rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Duhan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual's fear is the sphere of health. The situation in Iran is the following: that some medicines are produced domestically, at the same time the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Duhan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the U.S. in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries.
The UN Special Rapporteur has highlighted the negative impact of Washington's unilateral coercive measures on Iran, urging their immediate removal. But Iran is not the only victim of the U.S. sanctions regime. Washington has sanctioned more than 22 countries as well. One of those most effective ones is Venezuela, where, based on a report, thousands of people have died as a result.
Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision-making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
The U.S. warns that China is flirting with danger over Taiwan. President Joe Biden says his country will defend Taiwan militarily if China invades the self-ruled island.
That's a commitment we made. That's a commitment we made. We are not, look, here's the situation. We agree with a one China policy. We've signed on to it and all the attendant agreements made from there. But the idea that it can be taken by force, is just not appropriate. It will dislocate the entire region and be another action similar to what happened in Ukraine.
The U.S. president made a comment in a news conference with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida following their meeting. A White House statement said that Biden and Kishida committed to working closely to counter China's growing influence in Asia. Biden had endorsed Japan's plan to beef up its defense capabilities. China has responded to Biden's remarks, saying it's ready to defend its national interests over Taiwan. A spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry says that no one should underestimate the firm resolve and staunch will of the Chinese people in defending their sovereignty and territorial integrity. Well, I spoke to political analyst Kendo Shu, and he says that a U.S. statement regarding Taiwan is part of efforts to confront China and curb its rapid development.
You know, people often talk about this Taiwan or Ukraine, but it's two different situations by nature because Taiwan is part of China. People need to keep in mind, you know, what's the big picture here? The big picture is that Washington is trying its every bit to keep China down in the so-called competition. You know, this is not a true competition. Basically, they want to beat China because China is rising too fast. China is developing too well. So China cannot be allowed to be the dominant force in Asia. U.S. wants to do everything it can to maintain its global domination, including by using Taiwan, by sacrificing Taiwan in a proxy war. And then what Biden has said is really to make it clear that the U.S. will start a war on China in order to prevent China from achieving national reunification. So he's a true warmonger here. Not only playing a bigger role in the Ukrainian war, but here they are trying to start a war against the Chinese national reunification.
Now over to Australia, where Labor leader Anthony Albanese has been sworn in as Prime Minister, this way ending nearly a decade of Conservative rule in that country. Albanese and four of his ministers took the oath of office after his party won the national elections on Saturday. He's taking the helm hours before a summit in Tokyo with Japanese, Indian, and U.S. leaders as part of the so-called Quad Group. He said that the summit is an absolute priority for his country and an opportunity to send a message of change to the world. Albanese says that he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish in policy terms. In other news, Russia's lead negotiator is saying that Moscow is prepared to resume talks with Ukraine. Vladimir Medinsky says halting the talks was Ukraine's initiative, noting that the ball is in Kiev's court to resume them. The Russian official stressed his country never refused to engage in dialogue. The two sides have held several rounds of talks since the war began on 24th of February. Four ministers of Ukraine and Russia met for talks hosted by Turkey in March that ended without a breakthrough. The meeting was followed by another round in Istanbul, which also stalled. Ukraine's lead negotiator confirmed last week that negotiations were put on hold. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that diplomacy is the only way to resolve the conflict with Russia. In an exclusive report, Jana Miller has investigated the alleged single most deadly war crime of the conflict so far.
The drama theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike. This man worked at the theater.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement. He wouldn't speak on camera, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theater at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theater the morning after the explosion.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Economic divide.
The US dollar has been regarded as the world's number one currency, but it is being challenged like no other time in history. Not only is there a possibility of a new financial system that is being formed, more and more countries are opting to do their bilateral trade in their own currencies. One country, Brazil, is even considering forming a regional currency to break away from the dollar dependency. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of today's program. First, a weakening U.S. dollar. A depreciation has taken place since 2020. Inflation also has occurred, which is pointing to a U.S. economic downturn. That will contribute to the U.S. dollar weakening. Next, we will take a look at new global monetary order. One of them, CBDC, digitized domestic currency. That's regulated by the central banks, and that again contributes to a move towards de-dollarizing. And another highlight of the program, a new currency. Brazil's Lula da Silva, future presidential candidate, wants a new regional LATAM currency to break away from the dollar. Will that work?
The U.S. dollar is continuing down its path of losing its appeal as the number one currency of choice. There are many countries who are working hard to de-dollarize, especially when it comes to bilateral trade. BRICS countries are one grouping of countries that have started down this path from a long time ago, especially countries like Russia and China. Certain SCO member countries, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, are also conducting bilateral trade in their own currency. This includes countries like Russia, China, India, and Iran. Some of the reasons are not to have the long arm of U.S. sanctions reach these countries. Russia is a case in point. The unprecedented U.S. sanctions against this country, with the aim of destroying its economy, is having devastating effects in different sectors. But more importantly, when the U.S. confiscated Russia's dollar currency and foreign banks, that was a nail in the coffin for the dollar. Other countries have taken note and are dumping the dollar for other currencies in case they do not oblige to U.S. foreign policy directives. And Russia's ruble gain in value is another example of how the U.S. dollar is losing its appeal. Given that Russia is backing that with gold and not printer ink like the dollar, it has surpassed in value against the dollar.
The U.S. monetary system using the dollar as a weapon is being threatened in its efficiency, and then the dollar standing in more ways than one. The U.S. insistence to keep this war going, for example, on Ukraine, doesn't help matters either for the U.S. These are what some people thought online about this and whether there is a new monetary system competing with the U.S. Our first post, recent U.S. government actions will lead investors to diversify away from U.S. markets. U.S. bonds will lose safe haven status, and America's credibility will be lost. BRICS and others will buy OPEC's oil. Next up, a house of cards. The U.S.'s trade deficit is sustained by the dollar status as world reserve currency. Under normal circumstances, a country that does not produce real value collapses. When the dollar collapses, Americans will get squeezed harder. And then this post, sanctions are destroying the U.S. dollar's status as the world's top currency. Sanctions are destroying the dollar status because the continual use of sanctions to pressure countries and companies perceived to be acting against U.S. interests may also be weakening the dollar's global position. It goes on to say the convenience of simply prescribing sanctions as a one-size-fits-all is losing its effect and at the same time empowering the opposition. And in our final post, what people said, Lula hopes to see the creation of a Latin American currency in order to end the dollar dependency. Let me introduce our guest for this segment of the Q&A. We have Joe Emmersberger, who's an author, freelance writer at fair.org, who joins us. Okay, welcome to the program, Joe Emmersberger. Looking at how most economies are establishing different mechanisms to circumvent, for example, U.S. sanctions and also the hegemony of the U.S. dollar, these range from like using barter trade to trading in other currencies, of course, national currencies. And also, we're looking at the world moving towards multipolarity. Isn't it only a matter of time before the dollar, for example, loses its dominance when it comes to global currencies?
Yes, I think that's correct, but it's a question of how much time. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. I think it'll still take years. A lot will depend on what China does. For example, there's a rush, there's initiatives in China to develop more digital currency, a more digital, more modernized banking system.
Let me introduce Cesar Locatelli, an economist and independent journalist who joins us. Cesar Locatelli, welcome to Economic Divide. The future Brazilian presidential candidate, Lula da Silva, has actually proposed a move away from the dollar, or to have the dollar dominance to be decreased or lessened when it comes to not just Brazil but regional countries. And its introduction, he has introduced what's called a SOR. But it says regional countries can still use their currencies. What do you think about that when it comes to the introduction of a local currency in order to move away from the dollar? Because some countries are actually using their own currencies when it comes to bilateral trade.
Well, I'll say the same thing. It will help. We have to consider that in this case, I'm sorry for that.
Well, that's okay.
In this case, the roles the dollar plays as a medium of exchange in an international unit of value.
It's time now for the Info News section of the program. This is where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Well, our first topic takes us to the UK. Britons there are facing what's called a real food poverty. That is a warning that has been issued by a supermarket giant in that country. And that supermarket is Tesco, where Tesco's boss says people in the UK are actually struggling with the cost of living crisis. That comes, of course, on top of the inflation that that country is experiencing. And talk about inflation, let's go to the EU and see how inflation is doing cumulatively there for the bloc. The ninth EU country is actually seeing inflation jump to double digits. So you have nine countries in the 27-member bloc to experience inflation. Greece, in this case, has recorded its highest price increases in 28 years. So inflation is gripping the EU like many other parts of the world. Next up, limited energy supplies. Yes, that is a warning that has been issued by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, who have said that the world's dwindling energy supplies is what's occurring. They added that spare capacity is decreasing in all energy sectors, and this has happened in the wake of Russia's war on Ukraine. So when you have Saudi Arabia in particular issuing that kind of warning, first, to find out if that's true or not, if it is, very important. And secondly, we have to find out if there's actually politics involved in that warning. Finally, market sell-off. That's right. That is what has happened in this past week in the U.S. The S&P 500, the Dow Jones, suffering steep losses. Aside from those two major markets in the U.S., you also have the cryptocurrency market, which has lost more than half of its value. Now, as of the recording of this program, Bitcoin was actually below 30,000, which is roughly about half of its value. Okay, those were the stories that we found to be important in our view. If you have a story in your part of the world that you would like for us to cover in this program, please don't hesitate to drop us a line and tell us what that is. Contact information is on your screens now.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The world is moving towards a multipolar financial world. Some argue that it is here already. So is it or is it not? Can the U.S. financial system and the dollar survive it? That is what we'll be looking at closely in our in-depth section. Well, first things first. What is a multipolar financial system anyways? Well, in short, it is a system which will have a monumental occurrence. It will cause what's called de-dollarization. Basically, a multipolar financial system will arise due to a shock in the U.S. that causes a migration away from its currency. Next, for the U.S. dollar to actually lose its standing, it is widely believed that one of the major factors that will lead to that outcome will come from within the U.S., like the U.S. debt. Now, the U.S. debt ceiling comes into focus here, is the maximum amount of money that the United States can borrow by issuing bonds. But what if the figure was this? I mean, it's even hard to decipher what we're looking at here. $30 trillion as of when we're speaking is what this figure is. It's actually $30 trillion plus, $448 million to add to that, and counting. Although the cap on public borrowing has always been lifted just in time to avert a default, the failure of the U.S. to pay its debt would dent its attractiveness as a reserve asset. So that is something that many central banks are actually looking at. Well, taking a look at another factor that points to a break from the dollar are how countries are actually shedding the dollar from the reserves and opting to go for gold. Now, central banks around the world are increasing the gold that they are holding in foreign exchange reserves. This is a snapshot of that. Kazakhstan, Turkey, Russia of note because of the war that's going on. And then moving down, China is also another country to be looking at in terms of their gold reserves. This actually has brought the total to a 31-year high for the year 2021 in terms of the countries holding the gold reserves. Now, the value of the dollar against gold has dropped sharply over the last decade, and this reflects global concerns about the dollar-based monetary regime. It is worth noting the amount of gold reserves which exist underground. And here is the current supply. What countries actually have that amount? Well, coming in first is Australia at 19% of the world in terms of having the most, 10,000 tons. Again, of note, Russia, which has 7,500 tons. Then U.S., Peru, and then the rest of the world coming in at 51%. Now, when you take a look at Russia, it holds the second most gold reserves, more than double that of the U.S., coming in a short second behind Australia, which poses two questions. How can the U.S. think it can break Russia economically? And two, Russia can surely give the dollar a run for the money since, for example, the ruble is backed by gold, unlike the dollar. Well, since we have mentioned the currency, the ruble, then let's talk about the reserve currencies of central banks. They are more than ever before looking to diversify away from the dollar. And here is just a snapshot of some of the currencies around the world, such as the pound, or you're looking at the euro, or even the yen. And, of course, this is meant for the central banks to have a more diverse set of assets to move away from the amount of dollars they use. And it's especially true for emerging markets, where much of the demand for reserve assets is going to come from, which means more euros, renminbis, and maybe even stable coins, which will be held alongside what many say is still a popular U.S. dollar. All right, next up, the next order of the day is something that's rattled financial markets and is set to be the defining moment. And we're looking at a decentralized finance. Stable coins as a reserve currency is one of the features. And basically, that means that there are no controls by central banks. And that means that they cannot see where money is coming from in the form of digital currencies. Of course, some of the popular ones are cryptocurrencies. They are the ones that have contributed to this popularity. Next up, CBDCs, their central bank digital currency. And in this case in point, these are ones that are issued by the central banks. Now, the digital yuan helped China internationalize this currency, and that is something that's very important for the yuan. Next up, the Latin American currency, the SUR, is something that the future presidential candidate, Lula da Silva, has actually proposed. And basically, the ultimate goal is to decrease the dependence on the U.S. dollar. That is something that Lula da Silva is proposing, because this way the U.S. will not have control over the country overall in terms of the politics that's involved. And of course, the U.S. will then not be able to use the dollar, as some say, as a weapon. Okay, let's get some analysis into the picture. Let me bring in our guest, Joe Emmersberger, who's an author, freelance writer at Fair.org, who rejoins us. Joe, welcome back. So when we take a look at the proposal that the future Brazilian candidate, Lula da Silva, has said, and that is for the country, in particular Brazil, to be free from the dollar and then the regional countries by proposing this regional currency. Do you think it's going to work? I mean, this is, in terms of bilateral trade, he says the countries can keep their own currencies. But overall, what do you think about that scheme? Because countries already are using their own currencies in bilateral trade, like Iran, India, or Russia and China.
Well, all those are very positive initiatives. But I think the key thing to keep in mind is that the U.S. dollar is so dominant that it'll still take years for that to really make an appreciable a dent in the U.S. financial dominance. It's going in the right direction, but it's not like it's going to happen tomorrow. This is something that hopefully the countries that were under U.S. attack will not lose momentum and will not get in any way complacent about circumventing the U.S. financial system and broadening all these initiatives you talk about. But it's huge. A huge factor here is what China does.
Yeah, indeed. We're going to be looking out for that. Well, let's bring back Cesar Lucatelli, economist and independent journalist, who rejoins us. Welcome back, Cesar. Saudi Arabia had announced earlier that it is actually shedding some of its dollars, and it actually is going to sell some of its oil to China by pegging the oil sales to the yuan. What do you think about that? I mean, doesn't that, in essence, actually make the dollar lose its standing by changing its currency to the yuan?
The transactions being made in another currency other than the dollar will help debilitate the dollar. On the other hand, it seems, I don't know if I'm correct, but this change will follow the new geopolitical status of the world.
Brazil's former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has launched his presidential candidacy for this October's election, calling for unity around democracy. He's also vowed to fix the country's economy hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, Lula has proposed creating a Latin American currency in order to combat the dependency on the dollar. Lula da Silva has proposed expanding Latin American economic integration through the creation of a common regional currency. He says Latin American countries should use a unified regional currency. He revealed that the currency would be called the SUR, which means south in Spanish. Lula explained that countries in Latin America could still keep their sovereign domestic currency, but they could use the SUR to do bilateral trade with each other instead of having to exchange for U.S. dollars. The SUR could also help to contain inflation in the region. Lula said the goal of the currency would be to deepen Latin American integration and to strengthen the region's economic sovereignty, weakening its dependence on the U.S. Lula has also vowed to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture in order to challenge the Western financial hegemony. Five countries represent 41% of the global population, 24% of the global gross domestic product, and 16% of the global trade. Lula, who led Brazil through an economic boom from 2003 to 2010, has been in unofficial campaign mode since March of last year. He left office 12 years ago with approval ratings of 87% after presiding over a golden period that lifted some 30 million Brazilians out of poverty.
When it comes to the dollar, there are many factors that contribute to its strong standing, and the one that stands out the most is how oil is pegged to the dollar. Most oil exporting nations own their oil industries. That makes their national income dependent on the dollar's value. If it falls, so does their government's revenue. As a result, most of these oil exporters have pegged their currencies to the dollar. Now, we know that the relationship between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the US is on the rocks since both, as a part of OPEC, did not comply with Washington's demands to boost production. Well, things have actually turned for the worse. After getting snubbed by the UAE and Saudi Arabia and OPEC, the US is heading back. The US Senate committee has passed an antitrust bill pressuring OPEC. This bill could open OPEC and partners to lawsuits for collusion or boosting crude oil prices.
That is because before, OPEC countries had immunity that protected them and its national oil companies from lawsuits. U.S. lawmakers say that NOPEC is intended to protect U.S. consumers and businesses from engineered spikes in the cost of gasoline, something which the U.S. is accusing OPEC member countries of doing, although it's not saying that to them directly. As was expected, OPEC did not take this sitting down and has hit back, which could put a further strain on the U.S. and, in turn, gasoline prices. The UAE energy minister issued a warning to the U.S. that the NOPEC bill could disrupt the industry's long-standing system of production and increase prices by 300% or even higher. Sohail Al-Mazrui said OPEC is being unfairly targeted, adding, "If you hinder the system, you need to watch what you're asking for, because having a chaotic market, you would see a 200% or 300% increase in the prices that the world cannot handle." Here's how OPEC stands on the issue of boosting production on March 30th, before the war between Russia and Ukraine started, from the mouth of the Saudi oil minister.
"I would take that privilege of saying I've been at it for the last 35 years, and I know how we managed to compartmentalize our political differences from what is good for the common good, or the common good of all of us."
Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, they try to remain neutral. They try to remain in the gray area between those who impose sanctions on Russia and, of course, the other side is Russia. However, that also has many economic reasons behind it. I don't think OPEC producers, they want to seem allies of the United States when it comes to how much oil they produce.
All of this is, of course, bad news for the U.S., which is experiencing record oil prices. And with the war on Russia showing no signs of it ending anytime soon, oil production will not be increased the way the U.S. wants.
Europe's reliance on Russian energy is so high that you cannot easily wean off of it without having a significant economic impact in the region.
Why does this matter? Because the country that the U.S. made a deal to peg oil to the dollar, Saudi Arabia, is in active talks with Beijing to price some of its oil sales to China in the yuan. The talks have actually accelerated as the Saudi unhappiness has grown with Washington, surely to grow even more due to the NOPEC bill that was passed. This would dent the U.S. dollar's dominance of the global petroleum market and mark another shift by the world's top crude exporter toward Asia. That does it for my section. Hope it was informative for you.
In this program, we have outlined for you all the ways that the U.S. monetary system is being squeezed or challenged, I should say, including the dollar. Now, there's no doubt that countries are tired, in some sense, of the dependency on the dollar. For example, when it comes to the fact that the U.S. may exercise sanctions against them if they don't bend politically for the U.S. But all eyes are on China, then oil-producing countries, if they are going to accelerate their plans for pegging the oil sales to the yuan, for example. Saudi Arabia has done a portion of its sales that way. Add to that the multipolar financial system, which includes digital currencies. Well, the U.S. then has a lot to worry about, especially vis-a-vis the dollar. That does for this edition of the program. Hope you enjoyed it. From Mika Vitavoy and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the concept of dignity when it comes to human rights. And we mentioned in a previous episode that dignity is a God-given right to human being. In fact, it is the essence of every human being to have his dignity. Now, everyone obviously can conclude, obviously everyone with a sane mind can conclude that there is a necessity to have a government. And people, they must have a ruler, be it a good ruler or a bad ruler, as we say, birrun aw fajr. And in fact, that's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, and he said, people must have a leader, regardless whether he's good or bad. But a leader must be in place, because people, obviously, can only function when there is leadership and government. And no one could dispute this fact. Now, obviously, the discussion and the debate fell what type of government should we have? What type of ruler should we have? So, obviously, this concept we discuss. But when it comes to the essence of it, that we need a government, that we need a ruler, it is something that we do not disagree on. Now, when it comes to the people, those who try to look after the rights of people, and if I can put it specifically, let's say, the scholars of, let's say, if I can, you know, juggle these terms, the scholars of politics, because I don't want to call them politicians, because the definition of politicians today, it's very different than what it should be. When I say scholars of politics, because politics itself, it is a form of science, or at least a study, that requires those who have knowledge to deal with it, or to discuss it, or to bring it to people. Not anyone who becomes, or at least joins the parliament, or becomes part of the government, we can call him or give him the title politician, even though they do get it anyway, but sadly. So when we look at these people, these scholars of politics, they try to study whether the human being himself, does he have the right to decide his own fate, which is obviously, like we said, it's part of himself, part of his dignity. As a human being who lives in this world, who lives under a specific system or a specific government, do I and you have the right to decide our own fate? Or is it decided for us? And is this right given to us? Or is it taken from something else? Like, is it part of us that it needs to be given to us? Or no, this only applies to me when the time is right, or when certain things are into place. So do we have this kind of right to decide our own fate? Now, when we look at the answer to this question, and if we want to look at it from either the natural aspects of life, just a human being by himself, without being governed by anything, or with a system, or under religion or a faith, it takes a different answer. So before we dive into the answer, let us take a break, and then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Now, when we look at the answer to the question that we asked, is it, do we have the right to decide our fate? Or should the government decide it for us? Is it my natural given right? Or is it given to me when the circumstances are correct or right? Now, obviously, stemming from the Quran, and from the Ahlul Bayt, and from the Islamic teachings, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created mankind free. And if they are not free, then they need to fight for their freedom. If I and you are not free, if we cannot decide our own fate, then everything falls apart and everything has no meaning no more, especially when it comes to human rights. Now, the difference between a free person and a slave is that a free person can decide his fate and can decide his destiny, where a slave can't. He's stuck. He's under chains. He's owned by someone else. Now, sometimes these chains and this slavery takes different forms. When I and you are put in a government that we call a dictatorship, where people cannot do anything, then they have no right to decide their own fate or make their own destiny. It's made by them or to them by those who rule them. Now, is this correct? Well, obviously not. That goes against the norm. That goes against the nature of mankind. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants a person to create his own fate, because in the hereafter he will be judged upon that, his free choice to make his own free destination or his fate. So when you look at these governments, when you look at these states, they need to give people the right to make their own destination and their own fate. So when politicians, or at least the scholars of politics, as I call them, when they want to look at these laws, they have to make sure that these laws, when they talk about human rights, they have to make sure that the human being or the person, or let's even say the citizen, has the right to make his own choices and his own free decisions and free destination and free fate, if we can say that. And we see that when you look at revolutions throughout history and throughout the world, we see that the main reason why people revolt is the fact that they want to be free to make their own fate and their own destiny, not made by someone else. So now we go back to the topic of dignity. A human being, he's only dignified when he's free. He's only dignified when he has the right to make his choices. He's only dignified when he feels he is living a life of a free person. When he's not, then obviously all these things fall apart. Now, inshallah, we will continue this discussion in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.